The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I'm here tonight to urge you to set aside, at least for the next hour, any black or white views you may hold about fracking. Because tonight we are going gray, to the place where possibility lives, to the humanities, for a lens on our current energy craze. In short, I'm asking you to put on your thinking caps. Our first challenger is Adam Briggle, author of A Field Philosopher's Guide to Fracking, How One Texas Town Stood Up to Big Oil and Gas. That Texas town is Denton, where Professor Briggle teaches philosophy at the University of North Texas, and where he also serves on a citizens advisory group, which you may have heard about through various news outlets, including BBC, NPR, and The Washington Post. In a recent review, an essayist in The Times called A Field Philosopher's Guide an impressive effort to match the scope of thought to the scope of the real-world experiment suddenly being conducted close to playgrounds and neighborhoods. Briggle adroitly explores both the conflict without and the conflict within, between doubt and certainty, philosophy and activism. He'll be joined this evening by Jennifer Haig, a native of Western Pennsylvania, who created the fictional mining, now fracking town of Bakerton, PA, where she set some of her best-known tales, including the award-winning novel Baker Towers, the story collection News from Heaven, and her latest book Heat and Light. Miss Haig initially came to public attention with her Penn Hemingway award-winning novel Mrs. Kimball. Heat and Light has also received great praise. One critic compares Miss Haig's talents to those of the Three Richards. That would be the literary law firm of Russo, Ford, and Price. Janet Maslin, who made the aforementioned comparison, says Miss Haig is an expertly nuanced storyteller, long overdue for major attention. Her work is gripping, real, and totally immersive. I think the same is true of our first presenter's work. Please welcome Adam Briggle.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to try to keep an eye on my time up here. It's great to be here. I just flew up from Texas, which is the land that I would argue invented the fossil fuel age 2.0 with the modern hydraulic fracturing. And the story I tell in my book is a story of a city that long tried to rewrite the rules for fracking to make it more compatible with neighborhoods, and then eventually found that to be a fool's errand and banned it. I have just 20 minutes, so I'm going to just give you a thumbnail sketch of the story, cruising through some slides, because this was a lived experience for me as a member of this community, as a leader of the effort, first to try to regulate and then to eventually ban hydraulic fracturing in my city. So I wanted to just show you some of the pictures. And I'll do that thumbnail sketch in, I don't know, 10 minutes or so. But what I try to do in the book is more than just tell a story. I try to excavate the philosophical themes, the perennial issues that underline it. These are questions about knowledge, questions about power and democracy and justice, questions even about metaphysics and ethics and rights and all of that stuff. And so I'm going to, in the last 10 minutes, just, I think, land back on this slide and talk through one of those key questions. Again, as Andy said, in an effort to provoke thinking in different dimensions around this issue. Okay, so let me get started with the thumbnail sketch. This is a picture of, it's hard to do this in 10 minutes because it's like a 5-year story, a very personal story. But this is a picture of the neighborhood that really initiated the ban. You might notice the drilling rig here, which is less than 200 feet from homes. What the picture doesn't tell you is that this happened after we had passed an ordinance, a local ordinance, requiring fracking operations to be 1,200 feet from homes. And maybe we'll get to this in the Q&A if you want to. I can fill in the details why it was those rules didn't apply and why we eventually went to ban fracking in Denton. Let me run for you. Is this thing going to work? I wonder. Yeah. All right, you're going to watch an animation here that just gives you some sense of how quickly the fracking boom took off around the early 2000s. Denton, I've sort of circled up there for you. What you're seeing, those black dots, are vertical gas wells, the traditional style of gas wells. The red dots that come in 2004 are horizontally drilled gas wells. And by the time this animation is over, there are about 15,000 gas wells in the Barnett Shale. What you don't see on the animation is that this is also one of the fastest growing metroplexes in the country. And so you had a perfect clash of drilling and dwelling here in North Texas. Now there's about 17,000 gas wells. There's about 300 within the city limits of Denton itself. And this was, I moved to town in 2009, and this was the tipping point. This is a flare on a gas well next to what I call the Purple Park, McKenna Park. And this was when I got involved as a philosopher and academic trying to help the city rewrite the rules, because everybody agreed that this was not a good place to put fracking, right next to a hospital, a park, and a neighborhood. But the rules allowed it at the time. So we sought a way to change the rules. What we did initially is form this group. I was the chair of it. We just held meetings. We wrote reports. We brought in various stakeholders. We spent over 3 years just in a process of town hall style meetings and reports. We then got that ordinance passed, like I said, that stipulated a 1,200-foot setback. It's a 56-page ordinance. That was the biggest piece of it, though. But then they continued to frack 200 feet or less from neighborhoods. So what we did, and I don't know how many of you live in towns that have this provision in your charters, we took advantage of a citizen's petition provision where we could write our own ordinance. And so we wrote a ban on hydraulic fracturing. And we gathered signatures among Denton voters. We only needed, I think, about 2,000, because it's pegged to the number of people who vote in local elections, which is dismally low in Denton. I don't know what it is for you all, but for us it's about 8% of people actually vote. So this is a picture 2 years ago of us turning in our petitions once we had enough signatures. Again, I'm just giving you a thumbnail of the story here. After that, we did a lot of block walking, door knocking, talking to neighbors. We marched in the 4th of July parade to try to educate people about what we were doing, how to vote on this initiative. We had a public hearing that over 600 people came to. I mean, mostly there's about six people at the city hall for these hearings. 600 people came, news crews showed up. City Council could have adopted the ordinance that we wrote that night, but instead they decided not to, so it went to a vote. And it was a vote held on November 4th of 2014. And during that, I just put this slide up here. This is just a taste. So the oil and gas industry funded a campaign against us, linking us directly to the Russian government and other zany things, which you can all find in the book. And they outspent us 20-1. And I thought for sure we were going to lose because all we had was volunteers and they had a lot of money. But actually, to my surprise, we won. We won with 59% of the vote. This is a picture of me in the celebration night on November 4th, 2014, celebrating our victory. And it was, to me, an experience that, like I've never had, of actual grassroots democracy working. Feeling like we had developed bonds of political friendship, the stuff like Aristotle used to talk about, right there in our community where we came together. We formed a coalition of people. It didn't matter if they were Democrats or Republicans, young or old. We had a message that this was about common sense. We don't allow bakeries in neighborhoods, but we allowed fracking in neighborhoods. It doesn't make sense. So I think that message resonated with people and helped us eventually to carry the day. What happened after it, and that's where my book ends. So if you want to just end on a high note, it's this night, and I had to get the book turned in. I was writing the thing while undergoing this whole process, and I didn't know what would happen next. But I can tell you now what happened next, very briefly. We were sued by Texas Oil and Gas Association and the state of Texas. And I think, this is the way I always tell the story, that they believed that our ordinance was actually legal. And so most of the activity was not in the courtroom pursuing these lawsuits. Most of the activity was down in Austin at the state legislature, where they authored upwards of a dozen bills aimed at what was called the Denton fracking ban. That was all called these Denton fracking bills. And they were trying in various ways to strike down the ban. And one of those eventually passed on May 17th of 2015. And it was called HB 40. And what HB 40 did is not only ban bans, it wasn't just a ban. It was also a reversal of an 85-year tradition in the state of Texas, a common law tradition where courts routinely defer to communities to determine what is appropriate in their areas. And so if you look at the string of courtroom battles between cities and the oil and gas industry in Texas, you'll actually find that cities have a near flawless winning track record. And so what HB 40 did was took that standard which had been established and flipped it on its head. And it said instead of deferring to what a community finds reasonable, the new test for whether an ordinance is valid or not is whether it is quote-unquote commercially reasonable. And so that became and is now currently the law of the land. It's a law that I think is unjust. And so the last part of the story is in June of 2015 when the fracking came back to Denton after we had banned it, and of course the state house had squashed us. I went out with some friends to protest in an act of civil disobedience, blockading the gate site to the first fracking well that came back to Denton. This is a picture of Sergeant Jenkins shaking my hand before he had me handcuffed, just thanking me for my years of service to the community, and then telling me that I was engaged in an act of trespass, and so hauled me away. That's where we stand, though, in Denton at this point. HB 40 is the law of the land, and we're trying to figure out what to do. It's different than Pennsylvania. We could go into that, but I suspect I need to move on. Just a few minutes left. Let me just go back to that image and provoke some thoughts, hopefully. I've often said that more important than what the rules are for fracking is the question of who should write the rules. And this frames what most of the issue is turning around, which is a question of local control. And I'm very much in favor of local control when it comes to fracking, but I also recognize local control is not an absolute ideal. You don't want, for example, a city to be able to pass a discriminatory ordinance and say, well, it's what that city wants. So it actually does matter what the rules are and not just who makes them. But let's just think for a second about who makes the rules. We live in a democracy, so you might say, well, the people should make the rules. But then again, which people? Maybe you say the majority. Well, the majority of what group should make the rules? And what about minorities and their rights? Maybe you say, look, this is a scientific issue. The scientists should write the rules. Let the science decide, right? That's a common refrain. But again, I would say, which science? There's a diversity of sciences out there. And even if we could say, well, there's one true legitimate science and it's telling us this, there are always going to be, and I say that we're doomed to philosophize, there's always going to be ethics and values questions that are not scientific in nature. For example, how much risk is acceptable? How far away is safe enough? Those in themselves are not scientific questions. Those are questions for folks to answer. So we have to be aware of technocracy, where the experts make political decisions surreptitiously behind supposedly neutral language. Now, what maybe you'll say, well, those who own the minerals should decide. Well, in Texas, that gets particularly tricky because only 1% of the wealth extracted from Denton actually belonged to Denton residents because of the split estate that we have. So most people living on the surface, even if they own the surface property, do not own the minerals below. So what I argue in the book is those who are most vulnerable to the harms of fracking should be empowered with the greatest voice when it comes to making decisions about it. And those people, I said in the book, are the folks living in proximity to it. But you could say, and this is me just priming you to question me, wait a second, Adam. These are like wealthy, middle-class folks. They consume this oil and gas, shouldn't they have it thrust in their face so we can see what it is that we rely upon to lead the lives that we lead? Maybe this is a picture of justice right here, not injustice. Or you could say the real vulnerable people is the industry. After all, they're the ones who sink all of their capital and risk so much to make these things happen. They're the vulnerable ones. Or, last thought, and then I'll get going. Maybe it's the residents of the Marshall Islands who live way far away from here, but are the most vulnerable in terms of the climate impacts of fracking. Maybe they should be empowered to make local land use decisions in Texas and Pennsylvania and everywhere else. So last thought is, maybe we don't have the political institutions in place right now to make the decisions that our technology is thrusting upon us. Okay, I'll leave you there. Thanks so much.
It's great to be here this evening with Adam Briggle. I'm delighted to talk to you a bit about my new novel, Heat and Light. This is a book set here in Pennsylvania, in western Pennsylvania, where I was raised. And it focuses on a community where fracking is beginning to happen. I thought I'd read to you a little bit from early in the book, and then we'll have some time to do some questions afterward. So the character I'm reading about is a landman. He is an employee of a gas and oil company whose mission is to go door to door and lease mineral rights from landowners. The first truck comes in springtime, a brand new Dodge Ram with Texas plates. It trawls the township roads north of Bakerton, country lanes paved with Red Dog, pie crust roads that have never appeared on a map. The roads dip and weave for inscrutable reasons, disused mine trails, scarred and narrowed like the arteries of the very old. The driver, Bobby Frame, is as young as he looks, barely 30, a big husky kid who might have played high school football. Up and down the Dutch Road, he is welcomed warmly at the Feddersons, the Nortons, the Kiplers, Marlis Beals. "Are you some kind of a salesman?" he is asked at Friendly Acres, the Mackey Dairy Farm. "No, ma'am, just the opposite," Bobby says. At Cobb Krug's trailer, his first knock goes unanswered. When he knocks a second time, Cobb rolls to the door in his wheelchair, brandishing a shotgun. Bobby never returns. He bunks at the Days Inn on Colonel Drake Highway, room 211, the windows east-facing for an early start. Mornings he appears at the county courthouse as soon as it opens, clean-shaven, hair damp from his shower. He has a way with the clerk, a middle-aged lady who mothers and flatters him. Bobby hands her a printed list and waits for her to bring the books, the official record of who owns what. His approach is always the same. "Beautiful property you got here." This while removing his sunglasses, his eyes level blue and earnest in the morning glare. Except for Cobb Krug, folks listen as a matter of courtesy after he shows his business card and explained why he came. His explanation takes 2 minutes exactly. The shale lies a mile underground, has lain there since before there was a Pennsylvania, before a single human being walked the earth. Older than coal, older even than these mountains, it has an imperial name, the Marcellus. Deep in the bedrock of Saxon County, a sea of riches is waiting to be tapped. "Natural gas?" The words repeated with some hesitation, the first lesson in a foreign language, vowels and consonants in odd permutations, awkward in the mouth. Those who know the local lore make immediate connections. There is a mountain spring, secret but famous, that bubbles for no reason. In the woods north of Deer Run, at a spot called the Huffs, heady vapors seep through the rocks. The Huffs are popular for underage drinking. Teenagers pretend to, or perhaps really do, get high on the fumes. "Buried treasure," says Bobby, feeling the poetry. The Marcellus Shale is nature's safe deposit box, its treasures locked away like insurance for the future. Now, at last, American ingenuity has found the key. We drill a half mile down, then we turn a bit sideways. We can drill for miles like that right under your property. We're so far down, you'll never know we're there. You want to buy my land? The farmers ask, gobsmacked, as though Bobby has demanded a lung or a kidney, a piece of themselves God can't replace. Not buy, just lease it. You keep on farming it like usual. You get a bonus up front, 25, later 100, 500, 1,000, an acre. Once we start drilling, you get a percent. Again and again, the same response, what do I have to do? Reminding him always that they are farmers, lives of servitude, unrelenting effort. There's nothing to do, says Bobby with a grandson's smile. Sign the papers and wait for the check. Rural Pennsylvania doesn't fascinate the world, not generally. But cyclically, periodically, its innards are of interest. Bore it, strip it, set it on fire, a burnt offering to the collective need. Bakerton understands this in its bones, a town named for a mining company, Baker Brothers, and not the other way around. Chester and Elias Baker threw the first shovel, bought up the farmland and hired the men, Poles, Italians, Hungarians, Croats, who came in large numbers by wagon or train. The men slept in camps and later company houses. Their wives washed black coveralls and had babies, bought groceries with company scrip. The babies grew up, worked, married, were drafted. The lucky ones came back to mine coal. Union wages meant Fords and Chryslers, split-level houses. On Susquehanna Avenue, shops opened. The new public high school had an Olympic-sized swimming pool. When the mines failed, the reverse happened, like a film run backward. For sale signs dotted the avenues. One by one, the storefronts went dark. The miners, too, were extinguished. Black lung or heart attacks or simple old age. Never mind now, they're all equally dead. The children and grandchildren moved away, forgot everything. Only the widows remain. They will, if asked, point out the old mine roads, the clearings where tipples once stood. Baker 1, Baker 4, Baker 7, Baker 12. This past holds no interest for Bobby Frame, though he owes his success to it. The distant memory of boom times, the ghost of prosperity that lingers in the town. Here, grand promises are met without skepticism. The landowners are churchgoers, people of faith. The agnostics, there are a few, need only look to history. Bakerton has been favored before, tapped by industry's magic wand. He lives a nomad's life, which is not for everyone. 4 shale plays in 6 years, Barnett, Haynesville, Fayetteville, Marcellus. He's a star at the company, Dark Elephant Energy. 2 a year, they fly him back to Houston and turn him loose at a training seminar. This could be you someday, the new recruits are told, and take notes. If he's made sacrifices along the way, girlfriends who sent him packing, the college degree he didn't finish and now doesn't need. If he missed his high school reunion, family birthdays and holidays, weddings and funerals of people he loves. If regret can singe him without warning as he lies awake listening to motel noises, distant televisions, the ice machine down the hall. If all those things, so be it. In daylight, the phantoms dissipate. He appears at the courthouse at 8:30 promptly, his mind clear for the mission. Beautiful property you got here. The new recruits take notes. This Monday morning, a trainee shadows him. They roll along Number 9 Road, an old mining trail that intersects with the Dutch Road. The trainee guzzles coffee from a giant aluminum cup. They turn onto the Dutch Road, past Jim Norton's pine forest. Carl Neugebauer's southern pasture sits at the top of the hill. Bobby signed both properties last week. With Kipler to the east, that's 600 acres altogether, he tells the trainee. Wow, that's amazing. The kid studies the topo map spread across his map and locates each property with his finger. Kipler, Norton, and Neugebauer? What's in between, though? It's a big one. Parcel 112? There is an awkward silence. That's Mackey, dairy farmers. They need some time to think it over. Bobby keeps his eyes on the road. Both times Mrs. Mackey saw him coming and met him on the front porch. He hasn't so far made it into the house. Quickly, he changes the subject. Richard Devlin Jr. owns 60 acres. By all appearances, he's just sitting on it. Bobby drives slowly along the southern edge of the property. There is a newish suburban-type ranch house, prefab from the looks of it, and behind it, a patch of neatly mown grass. Beyond lie acres of deciduous forest, a creek in need of dredging, a sloping pasture overrun with kudzu. They pull into the gravel driveway. Up close, the house looks naked, not a shrub or a tree around it, as though it dropped out of the sky. No porch, not even a sidewalk, just a single-story cracker box wrapped in aluminum siding. Bobby knocks and waits. He hears voices inside, television noises. The door is opened by a young wife in a pink quilted bathrobe. "Can I help you?" She looks younger than Bobby, older than the trainee, but just barely. Blonde hair in a ponytail, glasses sliding down her nose. "Ms. Devlin?" Bobby introduces himself and the kid, whom he calls my associate. "Sorry to bother you so early." In fact, it's already 10 in the morning, the sun blazing overhead. Mrs. Devlin doesn't keep farmer's hours. She squints in the bright light. "Oh, that's all right. Come on in." The room is sparsely furnished in a way Bobby has seen before, the peculiar poverty of couples with young children. There is a couch, a giant television, and not much else. In one corner sits a plastic laundry basket filled with plastic toys. She leads them into the kitchen, sunny and airless, smelling of breakfast, toast crumbs on the counter, greasy dishes in the sink. At the table, a girl child, 3 or 4 years old, eats saltines off a plastic plate. "I stayed home from school," she tells him. Bobby sits beside her. "You look too little for school." The child takes umbrage. "I'm in kindergarten," she slurs like a tiny belligerent alcoholic. "Oh, she's small for her age. Is it just me or is it cold in here?" Mrs. Devlin hugs the bathrobe around her. "It's pleasant," says Bobby, already sweating through his shirt. Without asking, she pours them glasses of orange juice. "Rich worked a double. He should be back any time now." "Where does he work?" Bobby asks. "Out the prison." Mrs. Devlin frowns, as though wondering for the first time what these strange men are doing in her house. "I thought you were friends of his." Her bathrobe is floor length, bulky as a down comforter. Beneath it, presumably, she has a body. Bobby thinks of women in Arab countries, draped head to toe in cloth. "No, ma'am, though I look forward to meeting him. Your neighbor, Carl Neugebauer, thought Richard'd be interested in doing some business?" He launches into his pitch then, though it's a clear waste of effort. He'll have to rewind the whole thing when the husband gets home. When he finishes, Mrs. Devlin looks flabbergasted. "On our land? Are you sure?" Beneath the robe, she could be anorexic or 6 months pregnant, a mermaid or a double amputee. "Yes, ma'am. The geologists have already mapped the whole area. We have to do some additional testing, of course, find the best spot to drill." At last, he hears an engine in the distance, a scattering of gravel. A moment later, a screen door slams. Bobby gets to his feet just as Rich Devlin charges into the kitchen. He's Bobby's size, a big blonde man in a green uniform. His eyes go from Bobby to the trainee to his wife in her bathrobe. "Who the hell are you?" "Beautiful property you got here," Bobby says. That evening, back at the Days Inn, he takes papers from the safe. Leases signed and unsigned, topo maps, internal memos, engineers' reports. He piles them methodically on the spare bed and settles in for the evening. The television plays constantly, its volume muted. Bobby senses rather than sees the images flickering across the screen. The shifting light is a live presence. It warms him like a blazing hearth. 6 years in motel rooms. You develop a system for living. He is a natural traveler, descended from pilgrims, his great-great-grandfather born on the trail from Nauvoo. Bobby needs nothing beyond what the Days Inn offers. He uses and appreciates each amenity. The magnifying mirror for shaving, the coffee maker to heat water for his cup of noodles, the plastic ice bucket to cool his sprites, available at all hours from the machine down the hall. Years ago, in the Haynesville, he'd bunked at a comfort inn outside Baton Rouge and learned the value of the inn room safe. That establishment was crawling with landmen, his rivals from logistics, Diamond Energy, and Creek. This morning, he'd gotten a late start. He thinks again of the trainee's coffee, the travel mug stinking up his truck. The odor disgusts him, an ancestral revulsion, the one speck of Mormon still left in him. The rest of his clan has shed it completely by the looks of them. His sisters running wild, his father shrugging off the priesthood like an old sweater. Apostates, Jack Mormons, it's hard to credit. Bobby's father had missed his whole childhood, busy always, with some vague church business down at the stake. From his briefcase, he takes the signed contract. Rich Devlin had asked few questions. Left-handed, he signed carefully. He drew the letters deliberately, like a schoolboy who knows his penmanship is poor. He seemed surprised that his wife's signature was required, too. Bobby glances at the TV screen. An actor playing a pathologist stands over a cadaver. He places an organ on a hanging scale, the kind used to weigh supermarket produce. Similar shows play at all hours on multiple channels. Inexplicably, they are popular. People like to be grossed out. He unfolds the topo map and spreads it across the bed, 100 square miles of Saxon Valley. In the upper left quadrant, Sector 1, where the Dutch Road curves westward, most properties are already shaded blue. He takes a blue highlighter and colors in the square marked Devlin. The property borders Neugebauer to the south. Both can be drilled from the same well pad if the geology pans out. Blue means a lease has been signed, the property not yet developed. Sector 1 shows, at the moment, two solid but separate blocks of blue. To the south, Feddersen, Norton, and Yonner. To the north, Devlin, Kipler, and Neugebauer. Around and between them are a few odd parcels, glaring white and irregularly shaped, like pieces of a puzzle. These are Bobby's failures, the defeats that haunt him. Mackey, Rouse, and Krug. Rouse and Krug, he could have predicted, terse monosyllables, names for stubborn people. Bobby has noticed this time and again. The single syllables are unshakably convicted, a condition he knows intimately. His name, after all, is Frame. He places Devlin's signed contract in the safe. A horizontal well can swetch for 2 miles beneath several properties. Drilling requires contiguous parcels, the signed consent of everyone involved. Arvis Kipler signed immediately. His 300 acres are the linchpin. Farther to the south, Feddersen and Norton signed the very same morning, a sunny Monday. Feeling lucky, Bobby stopped next at Cobb Krug's trailer. He's been threatened before, but never by a man in a wheelchair. The camera zooms in on the meat, a human heart with visible apertures. Bobby conjures up names from high school biology: auricle, ventricle, vena cava, aorta. Words he connects to the neat line drawings in his textbook and not this revolting chunk of flesh. The old cuss ran him off with a shotgun, 12-gauge. The memory still stings him, the rudeness. Bobby was raised to value small kindnesses, the please and thank you and have a nice day. And yet, in the grand scheme, Cobb Krug doesn't matter. Like Rouse, the soybean farmer, Krug is an afterthought. Located at the far ends of the tract, neither property is a deal breaker. Mackey is the real problem. Mackey lies smack in the middle. There's no way around it. He has to have Mackey. The topo map is his daily accounting. Its companion, the stream map, depicts the kingdom to come. It shows the Dutch road divided into parcels, a broken line connecting them. That broken line is code for pie in the sky, the company's wishful thinking, the elaborate fantasy of a team of engineers. The project, known internally as the freeway, will connect Saxon County to the great neural network of interstate pipelines, the fabled Continental, the mighty Tennessee. These names are an incantation, their authority nearly biblical. Greater minds than Bobby's have planned the freeway's spurs and junctions, its ultimate trajectory through the lower 48. But only Bobby Frame can make it happen. Thy kingdom come. The Mackey farm connects Kiplin to Devler and Neugebauer. Mackey makes all things possible. Occasionally, on restless nights, alone in his motel room, his yearnings overcome him. It's Bobby's version of drunkenness, or what he imagines drunkenness to be. He envisions a supertract, Texas-sized: Rouse, Kipler, Mackey, Devlin, Neugebauer, Krug, Feddersen, Norton, Janer, Beale. The entire northern half of Carbon Township waiting to be drilled. Let it begin.
Please join me in thanking our authors for their presentation. So you each approach this topic of fracking in a very different way, but one of the things that your approach shares is sort of elucidating the complexity of the issue. And I wonder if you could A, elaborate on why that's necessary, and B, do you think it's just been entirely too simplified for consumption to be for popular consumption?
It is an extremely complex issue, I think. I don't think there's simple answers to most of the questions associated with it. And yes, I do think, in fact, I think I say this in the first page of my book, that we live in a hyper-media saturated environment. People have decreasing attention spans. I found that the average adult attention span rivals my four-year-old. She loses focus 12 seconds into a project, and many of my college students are about the same level. And it's something I'm really concerned about, frankly, is that we create situations with our technologies that require a sort of attentiveness and focus that we're losing. And I think that's one good thing books do. They kind of force you to sit down and think through something. So, yeah.
I agree about the complexity of the subject. I spent 5 years writing this novel, the first 2 years of which were almost all research. 5 years doesn't sound like that long a time until you consider that I do absolutely nothing else. I have no life. I don't have a job. I don't teach. I don't write book reviews. I don't have kids. I do nothing but write the book in front of me. And this was one of those books that expanded and expanded and expanded. There are probably 15 main point of view characters in this book. That was not my original intention. What I discovered as I learned a little something about this subject was how little a something I actually knew. And the more I learned about it, the more I understood that in order to do justice to the complexity of the subject, I had to give each of these characters his moment and his due. So what you see in this novel, it's kind of the magic of point of view, that I inhabit these characters one at a time. And in the moment I'm writing a particular character, I see the world through his eyes. So when I'm writing Bobby Frame, I take his side in all things. I agree with him on all things, even knowing that a week later I'll be writing a character who holds very different views about everything. And it seemed to me that was the respect I owed to each of these characters. And these are people on all sides of this fracking issue. And what I tried to do was convey very faithfully how these people see the world and why they believe as they believe. And that's how the book became so long and so complex, because there are so many different vantage points to look at this question.
This is what Aristotle called nous. He had five different kinds of knowledge. We tend to think of episteme, which is scientific technical knowledge. But I think we need to recognize this character you're writing about has a whole different set of axioms, or what we might call a worldview, than some of the folks he's talking to. And it's not really going to be the case that somehow a set of facts just changes their minds and switches over. I spent a lot of time wondering, why is there so much disagreement when we inhabit the same reality? And I'm not really sure we do inhabit the same reality, because we all kind of come at it with these beginning presuppositions about a whole bunch of things that you just have to kind of assert. Like, we hold these truths, right? You just have to hold them first, and then you can get going. So I think this is a great way to get at that point.
You know, I'm interested in what you said about how the complete inability of people on different sides of this issue to even communicate with each other. There seems to be such a chasm. And I think a lot of it comes down to class. There is an unspoken class subtext to this whole fracking question. The part of Pennsylvania I'm from, my dad used to call it Pennsyltucky, is certainly the barefoot part of Pennsylvania. And to people there, this issue looks quite different than it does to my friends in Boston, say, who have a pretty monolithic way of looking at it. And it really, 2-1, my friends in Boston see this as an environmental catastrophe in the making and cannot fathom why any community would consent to this. When I go back home to Western Pennsylvania, the conversation is very different. And it has everything to do with the devastating last 30 years those people have lived since the mine shut down, since Beth Steele pulled out. So it is a worldview that is so very different from the environmentally conscious people I know in Boston, that it's almost like they're speaking two different languages. And that's something I pay a lot of attention to in this book, the different languages people speak on this issue.
The fact that you called it Beth Steele is sort of a realization, too. There's nobody I know, even people who work there, at least on this side of Pennsylvania, who called it Beth Steele. It was always Bethlehem Steele. Like, this formality and this distance from it, as opposed to somebody who it's almost personified when you call it Beth Steele, has this feminine aspect. Strange.
I'm not sure I formulated my question. I'll try to get to a question. I guess I'm thinking about how, you know, Philadelphia right now, many of us here have been fighting fracking for 7 years or more, protecting the Delaware River Basin, going to Western Pennsylvania, talking to people who can't drink their water, you know, cows have died, all those, you know, horrors have been very real, and we're in touch with that. And now Philadelphia is under the pressure of the industry really strongly, with pipelines and the exports are happening from the Delaware River, from Western Pennsylvania, where the natural gas liquids are coming, the 300-mile Mariner East pipeline. So it is a huge fight. And I guess my question is, What about those that are not in the room? Because what I hear you talking about is characters in local towns, in small municipalities, in rural areas, which I'm very familiar with, Bradford County, Butler County, all those, Fayette County. But what about the future generations? What about the animals? What about, like you said, the folks in the Pacific Islands, the Marshall Islands, the folks who are who are hardest hit by climate change?
Why don't we leave it at that and let them answer?
Sorry for such a long question.
Well, I'm right there with you wrestling on this question. You know, that's one of the ironies of local control, because it's a local control of a globalized commodity production system, which it has sends its tendrils around the world. And so it's a little bit odd to think that we could just freeze frame and take a picture around this one extractive process as if it's not connected to the pipelines and the climate and everything else. And sort of thinking globally, acting locally sounds nice, but it doesn't add up. And so I start thinking about Plato in Book 6 of the Republic, when Socrates says we need a philosopher king. Because that's the only, you need somebody who can kind of see the whole thing and make sense of it. And I think we've thrown all of our faith into a system that's predicated on the spontaneous coordination of independent initiatives, that somehow you doing your little thing and you doing your little thing via the invisible hand will add up to the greater good. All of it selfishly motivated. And I think now with the ecological crises we're seeing, we're just seeing kind of the bankrupt nature of that logic. But what to do about it, I don't really know. I mean,
both my wife and I came down from Bethlehem tonight, and in the Lehigh Valley, it's just known as the steel, not Bethlehem steel. Do you work at the steel? But anyway, Jennifer, I'm curious as to where you grew up in Western Pennsylvania. That's your question. And Adam, I read recently about the increase of earthquakes in Oklahoma, which are thought to be the result of fracking practices. I just wonder, is Texas similar as far as that goes?
Okay, well, I grew up in Cambria County, about 70 miles northeast of Pittsburgh. There's nothing up there. It was coal mining country for 150 years. Both my grandfathers were coal miners. 6 of my uncles were coal miners. It was a company town called Barnesboro, and it really was named after a coal mine. The Burns and Tucker coal mine came first, and then came the town. I say was because Barnesboro, Pennsylvania, doesn't exist anymore. You can't find it on a map. I was in junior high when the mine started shutting down, and by the time I graduated high school, it was all over. My town shrunk so rapidly that in the year 2000, the town council voted to merge with the town next door and give it a new name. So Barnesboro, Pennsylvania doesn't exist anymore. It's now called Northern Cambria, the northernmost town in Cambria County. And it is a shell of what it once was.
It's amazing. That's the exact opposite of where I'm coming from with Denton's uncontrollable growth. Texas, yes. Earthquakes are happening. They're primarily from the injection wells. One interesting difference between Oklahoma and Texas has to do with the science of this. This is one of those cases where the science is very clear. The USGS unequivocally has linked injection wells to earthquake activity. Oklahoma denied it for a long time because it's in a system where they're playing merchants of doubt, just like the tobacco industry does. But they were finally compelled to admit, yes, this is happening, and they have. I was just there last week. The state regulators have forced them to slow the rates at which they're dumping stuff into the earth. Texas, though, we still have a state seismologist who works at the Railroad Commission, which is in the pocket of the industry, that's denying every study that comes out that links fracking and injection wells to earthquakes. And just one this week came out very clearly, University of Texas at Austin, SMU, which is up in my neck of the woods, both of them saying, look, this has been happening, it's obvious, and the Railroad Commission says, well, we need more data on that. So that's what's going on.
Hi, thank you for your wonderful information about all this that's going on in our state, Pennsylvania. But just curious, after all that effort and that then to be faced and win and then to be faced with such a defeat, how, first of all, were you able to gather strength to keep going on? And have you found some stronger, bonds with companies or that would be supportive of your effort?
No, companies won't talk to me anymore. Initially, we had good conversations, and then that fell apart. I was really feeling defeated until just the other day. I was at a meeting of that group that I helped to form. And somebody said, you know what? They can never take away that victory that we had. And the other thing they can never take away is the community that we formed. You know, we actually formed and educated a whole bunch of citizens who are now engaged in the public sphere in ways they would have never been. So we really kind of lit a candle of citizenship within a bunch of people. And that gives you some hope, you know, that even if that particular legislative triumph was overturned, it hasn't overturned the sense of empowerment that people have got. So I don't know where we're going to take it, but it's there, you know. So we're just kind of struggling to figure out how we can move within our newly constrained legal system.
Years ago, when you wrote Bigger Towers, you told me something that really haunts me, that as you went around the nation on your book tour, that you encountered so many of our diaspora. You said you wouldn't believe how many people used to be from Pennsylvania. One of the themes of your book is about what it means for people to be without the dignity of work, and you use the metaphor of addiction. Could you just talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So the novel deals with the fracking question, but it also deals with the full range of difficulties that this region has had, which has everything to do with why people respond the way they do to what they view as the opportunity to lease their mineral rights. The town that I grew up in is very typical of other towns in that region where people are sorely underemployed. People my age and younger have moved away in droves. So the ones who've stayed have very narrow options for making a living. So for a lot of these people, when somebody offers to lease your mineral rights, it seems like manna from heaven. It seems like the first good news you've had in a very long time. Addiction is also a big piece of the culture in this town, which is absolutely true to Western Pennsylvania. There's a real methamphetamine problem. There's a burgeoning opioid problem. And all of this, of course, is tied to the lack of opportunity and the sort of the narrow range of options people have. So that is all part of the texture of this book. Because the truth is, when fracking is happening, no matter how invested you are in the outcome, it's not the only thing going on in your life. You're still getting up and going to work. You're still fighting with your husband. You're still raising your kids. You're still doing all the living of life. And that's one of the challenges you have in a novel. You know, this isn't a screed about fracking. It's me trying to look very honestly at the totality of people's lives when this is going on. And that includes all the other things that are going on, too. And so part of that fabric is, you know, the economic realities of living in this part of the world, the extreme vulnerability of people in this part of the world, and the sort of chain reaction of dysfunction that happens in people's lives when they don't have the dignity of work and don't have opportunity. So the book is about all of those things. Truly, I feel that every thought I've ever had is in this book. And I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do next. I'm going to have to learn how to do hair or something.
Jennifer, when you said that you've done research for 2 years, I'm interested in how much research you did for Bigger Towers, too. But also, it seems like you have such a personal relationship with actual people who can speak to you. Would you say that that was more important than reading articles? Or, I mean, is it possible to do research without that type of personal connection with real people?
Not for me. I do all sorts of research. You know, you have to understand the mechanism, and these are complicated processes. So there was a lot of remedial knowledge I had to acquire just to begin having conversations with people. I had to understand basically how it all works. That took a shockingly long time. But I think the most helpful research I did for Heat and Light came in the form of conversations with people. And I talked to landowners who've leased their mineral rights and landowners who've decided not to. I've talked to people who were in favor of fracking and people who were very upset about it. I've talked to environmental activists. I've talked to geologists, all sorts of different scientists. And I've talked to a lot of guys who work on drill rigs. And each of these pieces was necessary in order to construct this novel. It is an elaborate, constructed thing. And I would not have been able to do it without the generosity of the people I spoke to. Initially, there were people who did not want to talk to me when they learned the subject of the book and made certain assumptions about me as a writer. And so, fair enough, people said no. But most people eventually did say yes. And I think it has to do with the kinds of questions you ask people. I don't ask gotcha questions. I don't try to find fault with people or tell them what they're doing is wrong or how they should live differently. I want them to make me understand how they do what they do. And when you approach it in that way, almost anybody will talk to you. You know, when I talk to guys who work on drill rigs, I want to know, like, what hurts at the end of the day? I mean, this is physically demanding work. This is hard work. And not all these guys are 20 years old. Some of them are. But some of them have been doing this for a good long time. And I want to know, you know, what hurts? Does your back hurt? Do your knees hurt? So what I'm trying to do is tunnel my way inside what it's like to be that person. I think of writing a novel as the supreme act of empathy. That's my mission as a writer, is to understand faithfully what people's lives are like and try and get that on the page. So most of that happened in conversation.
And Adam, as a field philosopher, what is your MO, the way that Jennifer's is?
Well, I mean, it's actually similar in some sense. Field philosophy is a coinage of my mentor, Robert Frodeman, and it's supposed to be in distinction to disciplinary philosophy, and it has to do with who do we talk with. Disciplinary philosophy, like any discipline, is where you talk only to your fellow adepts who have also read, you know, Hegel or whatever, right? And you can kind of jump into an assumed world that they live in. Whereas field philosophy, very much like what you're saying, is you have to first invite somebody to tell you what it's like and how do you see the problem, right? Let them frame it for you, and then what you're looking for to do as a field philosopher is to find interstices there where you might say in a crack, in a moment, something insightful that somebody with your particular background is able to say that nobody else could say, that would then give them a particular swerve or a twist that might be helpful. You clarify something that was unclear, or you murkify something that was too clear, or whatever it may be. So I think it's kind of similar, actually, in a way.
Yeah, it sounded that way to me, too. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Adam Briggle and Jennifer Hay. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.